Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
No, I grew up in the day and time when we had to do a lot of chopping and hard labor, and I said, I'm going to college, I'm getting my degree, and I'm going to work in the air conditioning.
But Elijah Pullen is back on the farm because he likes the feel of the ground under his feet. We'll hear more stories from his farming life in this episode. Megan Betts describes how working with a community orchard is actually more about community building than about scoring berries for your breakfast. Greens are on the menu with Chef Daniel Orr. An update from the Great Plains as farmers continue to recover from the 2012 drought. And the best breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is being made in a most unusual location. Our show always kicks off with a look at some recent food headlines. Here's Luann Johnson.
Last week, Russia banned imports of meat, fish, dairy, and produce from Europe and the U.S. This week, experts are looking at how the year-long embargo will impact EU farmers. Peach and nectarine farmers will receive aid from the European Commission. They will also remove some of their fruit from the market and instead donate it to schools, prisons, and hospitals. Poland could be most affected by the ban, as Russia is its biggest buyer of apples. As a result, suppliers in France are concerned a glut of Polish apples could push down prices of French produce. Keep an eye on our Twitter feed for the latest updates on the food ban in Russia. We're at Earth Eats. The latest report card on home-packed school lunches probably won't get pinned to any refrigerators. Researchers at Tufts University graded snacks and lunchboxes from hundreds of third and fourth graders and found less than a third met at least 3 out of 5 federal standards. With about 40% of the country's students bringing lunch from home, the findings spotlight a big challenge in the fight against childhood obesity. About a quarter of the lunches in the study lacked any kind of entree, but contained plenty of packaged snack foods and desserts instead. Researchers also found that overall, about half of the calories from added sugar that kids consume come from sugary drinks. Previous research has noted that parents grapple with time, cost, convenience, and children's preferences when choosing what to pack in lunchboxes. A study last year from the Baylor College of Medicine noted that parents who opt out of school lunch often claim they're able to provide better nutrition for their kids by sending food from home. But the Tufts study and others have shown that school lunch regularly beats packed lunches for nutritional value. In the Baylor study, 29% of school-made lunches had a full serving of vegetables, compared to only 13% of packed lunches. And in case you missed it, the USDA has rolled out sweeping changes to its poultry inspection regulation, the first major revision in more than a half century. The new rules allow companies to adopt a controversial system that puts plant workers in charge of some types of inspection. In a release, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack said the system, quote, imposes stricter requirements on the poultry industry and places our trained inspectors where they can better ensure food is being processed safely, unquote. Read what critics of the new regulations are saying on our website.
Links to read more about these stories are at eartheats.org. The voice of the news is Luann Johnson.
See you next week.
Drought is still hammering southeast Colorado, western Kansas, and the panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas. In some areas, it's drier than it was during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. And yet, many farmers are avoiding tragedy. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon traveled to the drought-stricken farms and brings back this report.
This spring, when the wind picked up from the south on John Schweizer's farm outside Rocky Ford, Colorado, the sky would go black. The 80-year-old farmer and his wife would be forced inside by a wall of dust charging down the plains.
And you'd look up and here'd come this big old rolling dirt.
How high would it be?
Well, you couldn't see how high it was.
The dust storms looked eerily similar to the ones you'd see on the pages of a history textbook. Some areas haven't seen a lack of moisture like this since we started keeping weather records. Schweizer says the cracked, dusty ground won't even absorb the moisture when it does decide to rain.
It was as bad as I remember ever seeing.
How then is a farmer like Schweizer making a living? None of his neighbors have skipped town like Dust Bowl refugees. Farmers aren't marching on Washington demanding relief.
Oh, I think the people are doing fine because most of them have been around long enough to know that you have to take the good with the bad, and most people just accept that. If they didn't, they wouldn't be farming in the first place.
The 2012 drought is severe and very comparable to what we saw in the Dust Bowl.
That's Eugene Kelly, a soil science professor at Colorado State University. He says farmers like Schweizer are able to keep their farms up and running, even in Dust Bowl conditions, largely due to changes in agricultural technology and practices. Farms in the 1930s relied on primitive horse-drawn plows. Now farmers are adopting newer conservation practices, like planting cover crops, limiting tillage, and updating irrigation.
I think they're able to sustain the production in some of these areas, but I think that came from a lot of research and a lot of work in developing cropping systems and farming systems and learning a lot about the damage a plow can do.
That damaging plow made the Dust Bowl one of the largest and most destructive human-caused ecological disasters in history. Homesteaders dug up marginal lands to plant row crops like wheat. Without rain, the soil dried out and sprung into dust clouds miles long whenever the wind kicked up. In the decades since, former U.S. Department of Agriculture conservationist John Knapp says a suite of conservation programs has gone into effect, programs that pull those sensitive grasslands out of agricultural production and keep the soil intact.
That really changed what was the Dust Bowl, because those lands are in grass now, and that's some of the most highly erodible lands anywhere in Colorado.
But Knapp says even though some farmers have been able to adapt to a harsh environment, the economics of such a transition can wreak havoc on the small communities involved. Selling off cattle or relying on insurance is tough on farmers and on the surrounding towns.
Even prior to this particular drought, we have been on kind of a bit of a slide in terms of the economics, just because we weren't able to sustain some of the higher value crops.
Crops like onions and melons. Knapp says packing sheds have closed, and farms need fewer workers. The farmers who are left are likely doing more work but making less money. Some are selling out completely. Those are larger economic issues, not necessarily caused by drought, but certainly exacerbated by it, Knapp says. But as the world has changed in the 80 years since the Dust Bowl, today's economic hardships are less harsh. Farmer John Schweizer grew up as a child of the Dust Bowl. He says at the time, he was relatively unaware of the historic event taking place on the family farm.
One time, my mom, I caught her unaware, I guess, and was talking about it. Anyway, she said, "You kids never went to bed hungry, but your dad and I did." That's how tough it was. But I've never known bad times, I guess, in comparison.
The current drought will leave a mark on those who live through it, and it remains to be seen whether the next generation of farmers in this region will be able to adapt quickly enough to survive even more extreme conditions in the future. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
The reporters at Harvest Public Media spend time speaking with farmers and recording stories of rural American life. The series My Farm Roots is a collection of these stories. Today, Jacob McClelland brings us a profile of a farmer from southeastern Missouri.
Elisha Pullen is carrying on family traditions. He's a third-generation pastor and farmer in the fertile gumbo soils of Missouri's Boot Heel. When he was young, he left the farm, but deep family connections sucked him back in.
I am Elisha Pullen, and I live here at rural Bell City, Missouri. I have a farm that is 100 acres, and I farm basically soybeans. My grandfather moved from Mississippi here in the area of 1923-1924, and he bought a farm. And then later on, after my dad got grown and married, then he bought a farm. He was a big man, tall man, like 6'2", 275. He had big hands, and when he spoke, you just moved. To us, he was just daddy, but some people said he had a voice of many waters. Mm-hmm. That's the description that is given in the Bible about God. the voice of many waters. So that was really an honor. No, I grew up in the day and time when we had to do a lot of chopping and stuff like that, and hard labor. And I said, I'm going to college. I'm getting my degree, and I'm going to work in the air conditioning. And I majored in accounting and with a minor in computer science. And from there, I went to work for Missouri Utilities Company. But no, I had no intentions of farming anymore. When my brother got sick and he told me to come and farm the ground for him, and I said, well, okay, all right. And so that pulled me back in. So here I am today. Who will take over after I retire or whatever? I don't know yet. Most family have gone. I only have a nephew that is farming now, and I'm not really sure that he's really interested in it. He's just doing it because it kind of fell in his lap. You know, I've been asked, well, aren't you ready to move to Sykeston? And I just don't know if I could stand having a neighbor 30 yards away from me, or, you know, because I never had that. It's just always been spacious, you know. And, well, your neighbor, you wave at him way down the, you know, at least a quarter mile down the road or something. And to have one close enough where they can almost look into your house, oh, no, I don't, you know. But I like the open air, the fresh air. I like the ground. I like being able to touch the ground instead of walking on concrete all the time. And, you know, whenever I go somewhere, in a few days, I'm ready to go back home where I can relax and be free, you know. So.
KCUR's Jacob McClelland and farmer Elijah Pullen. Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration. More stories about food and agriculture at harvestpublicmedia.org. Chef Daniel Orr has cooked all over the world, from France to New York City to the Caribbean. He brings that wide range of experience to the kitchen today with a traditional Indian dish.
So our mantra at Earth Eats is local ingredients with global flavor. And we're going to go there again today. We're making a saag. It's pureed greens, and usually it's served over paneer, which is a cheese. Now, most places in America use spinach because that's the simplest green. But in India, they have different saags for different times of the year. Today, we're going to use actually mizuna, which is a Japanese mustard grain. So we're going to mix that with a little arugula and a little spinach so it has a nice balanced flavor. The mustard might be a little bit too aggressive, too strong. What I always do with aggressive flavors like dandelions and mustard greens, you add a touch of sweet, a touch of heat, and a touch of fat. I'm using what I call Purple Haze mizuna, just because I like Jimi Hendrix, but so I've renamed it Purple Haze. But it also comes in just a regular bright green. Just pull off the leaves and leave the stem behind. So you just kind of like put two fingers together and pull it straight through there, and that removes the greens. All right, so we got a nice big hot pan. Okay, we're going to add some olive oil, garlic, ginger. I'm going to add the red onion, which is about two medium red onions, diced small. We're going to make this a little spicy, so we're adding jalapeno.
What is this?
Okay, they're throwing some arugula. Then we're going to throw in a handful of spinach. It's about 2 pounds of greens total. So this is a big mess of greens. But again, when you cook this, it will be about a quarter of that volume when we're done. Okay, I'm going to add a cup of cream, teaspoon and a half, 2 teaspoons of toasted cumin. And anytime you use large seeds, cumin, coriander, fennel seeds, if you toast them, what's going to happen is the essential oils are going to come out. They're going to be more perfumey, have a different flavor than if you just use them straight out of the jar. And then we're going to sprinkle cornmeal on top. And what the cornmeal is going to do is anytime you cook greens, a lot of moisture comes out of them, and the cornmeal is going to absorb some of that moisture, so you don't have a real soupy, watery greens dish. Okay, we're going to take this back to the fire, cook them down, and I'll meet you back here in about 3 or 4 minutes.
In real kitchen time, it takes more like 8 to 10 minutes to cook down the greens, and that's right around the time when we'll check back in with Chef Orr to see how this dish is coming together. Before that, a staple of Midwestern cuisine.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana.
Breaded pork tenderloin sandwich connoisseur Rick Garrett speaks with Traditional Arts Indiana, coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We're back at the Bloomington Community Orchard with Megan Betts.
It was really hard for me not to eat it all, but I saved some for you.
Let's do this right now. What do we have here?
We have some ripe raspberries and blackberries. And we had Harvest Festival on Saturday, so it's a miracle that they're still here.
A couple episodes ago, she talked with us about why it's hard to get a community orchard up and running. Today, we start with a taste test of some of the berries grown in the orchard. Temperatures have been cool this summer, so the berry crop is behaving weirdly. Lots of still unripe berries on the vine. But Betts managed to find 4 berries that taste as good as they look. You're going to eat with me, right?
Yeah, because I absolutely have not been eating them for the past, 20 minutes I've been out here.
Megan Betts studies how we use spaces like the Bloomington Community Orchard. She'll be back in a bit to tell us about her research. The breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is a dish indispensable to Indiana taste buds. It's generally accepted to have been invented at Nick's Kitchen in Huntington, Indiana, but Iowa has also staked a claim to the title of home of the tenderloin. Betsy Shepherd of Traditional Arts Indiana's Second Servings takes a closer look at this Midwestern staple.
Any Hoosier menu that doesn't include the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich has a mammoth hole in it. The breaded pork tenderloin, which often spans the size of the plate on which it's served, is a mainstay in Indiana cuisine. According to Rick Garrett, the breaded pork tenderloin connoisseur who has been featured on the Food Network, Indiana identity is defined, in part, by this celebrated staple.
Like the Indianapolis 500 and all the IU championships are certain things that people relate with Indiana. And I think the breaded tenderloin is one of those.
Why the breaded pork tenderloin? And why Indiana? To understand that, you have to understand its origins.
The story that I have got is that the family that owned the original restaurant was a German family. And there is a German dish called schnitzel, which is basically a breaded veal cutlet. In Indiana, in the 1920s and 30s, veal was not a real common commodity, but pork was. So he thought, I wonder what would happen if I bred this, and a legend was born.
Rick's love for breaded pork has taken him all over the Midwest in search of the perfect sandwich. And according to Rick, the best breaded pork tenderloin sandwich is found in one of the unlikeliest of places.
My most memorable pork tenderloin ever was at a filling station, of all places, in Knobbone, Indiana. And there was just something about biting into that exceptional sandwich in a gas station that just made it a great experience.
If that description wasn't enticing enough, then for the love of adventure and all things pork, my coworker James and I decided to take a pilgrimage to Gnawbone to see for ourselves what people were hailing as Indiana's holy grail of breaded meat. So how did we find the off-the-grid joint Rick was talking about? Roger Sharp, the owner of Gnawmart, made it easy for us.
That's why on my sign it says home of the original Gnawbone tenderloin, because I am the originator of this tenderloin.
Roger was tight-lipped about some of his specialty ingredients, but ever the gracious host and breaded pork promoter, Roger gave us a tour of Gnawmart and walked us through the step-by-step process of sandwich making. First, he soaks them in a marinade.
This is what they look like after they've been in my marinade. I take them out and drain them. The drier they are, still want them tacky. The breading sticks to them good, and it doesn't hurt my oil.
Then he hand breads them. And finally, his tenderloins are broasted, not fried.
We're going to put this in here, and I'm not going to tell you how long. We're not going to put them in something and let them soak in oil and get saturated with oil. We're going to put them in here, and instead of cooking from the outside in, we're going to cook them from the inside out.
And now for the moment of truth.
All right, here goes. Time for the taste test.
Yes,
oh my goodness.
It's like a better chicken nugget.
You'll have to excuse James. He's a vegetarian. Once you try their breaded pork tenderloin sandwich, it won't be a mystery why people keep going back. Gnawmart and many of the local diners that specialize in breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches are places where people gather to enjoy the foods that define what it means to be a Hoosier.
Thanks to Betsy Shepherd and everyone at Traditional Arts Indiana for that report. Hear more from their second serving series at traditionalartsindiana.org. The door at the Bloomington Community Orchard is something out of a fairy tale. It's made from branches and sticks. It's tall, and it creaks when you open it. It feels like a portal to a magical space. The door is a necessity because there's a fence surrounding the trees. From what Megan Betts says, organizers probably would have preferred to not have a fence at all.
You know, a fence is a huge social barrier. We don't want to go through fences. So I just think it's important to reinforce the idea that it's a deer fence and not a human fence.
She's the communications team leader at the orchard. This plot of land is in a park next to a playground and a picnic shelter. A huge community garden area is on the other side of the parking lot. But those gardens and this orchard could not be more different.
With the community gardens, you're paying a fee. You're using it for a year. You have a space. You only harvest from that space. So if you want to never talk to anyone else, that's fine. But in the orchard, you don't have a space. We all have the one space. And if I only live here for 2 years and only want to use the space for 2 years, I may eat from it. I may not.
She says volunteers work in the orchard for any number of reasons, from wanting to build a community space to helping increase biodiversity.
I think a lot of people who come to the orchard aren't seeing it as a way to necessarily increase the amount of produce that they take home every week. It's more about community and having a space where if someone needs it, they can come get it, which is just a really, really interesting question when you have a space that starts to define itself as a commons, which necessitates this whole other management structure and some sense of, you know, who is the community and who is not.
This orchard is managed by a group of volunteers. The community garden is run by part of the city government. In terms of who is the community, well, that's the most pressing issue currently for the orchard.
So trying to find ways to reach into pockets of the community where there's more need and do that in a way that's inclusive and not reinforcing any sense of in-group or out-group or any sense of obligation in terms of what I have to do to earn the right to this food. It's just here, and we did this together, and it's public space, so that's why it's for everyone.
The idea is to create a culture of sharing and to not question that. Looking around, there are lots and lots of green berries on the raspberry and blackberry bushes, thanks to the chilly summer we've been having in southern Indiana. Nevertheless, organizers held their annual Harvest Festival at the end of July, which Beth says was a huge celebration.
No one's, you know, worrying about whether you're washing the fruit first, and no one's scared of bees, and everybody's getting a little sunburn, and we all have, like, pit stains, and nobody cares because it's just this amazing thing that we've spent all these hours watering, and now we just get to eat.
Megan Betts studies how people use spaces like community orchards. We've got more information about her research and the work that's being done at the Bloomington Community Orchard at eartheats.org. Been about 8 to 10 minutes, and Chef Daniel Orr is just a couple more steps away from serving up his pureed greens, also called a sog.
All right, so we've cooked this down, and you really want it to be kind of wilted, melted. This isn't one of those dishes that you want to have the greens crispy and crunchy. It's more of, you know, get that nice mouthfeel, kind of a velvety, creamy mouthfeel. We're going to serve it with paneer cheese, and I'm going to show you two different ways that you can do it. You can serve it right out of the dish like this, where it has the big pieces of leaves, or you can put it in a blender and make more of a sauce out of it. So I'm going to take about half and half. And what I have is some paneer cheese. We've just warmed that up and served the sog right on top of it. Okay, and the other, I'm going to put in the blender. Still nice and hot. And I'm going to add just another handful of spinach. And what that fresh spinach is going to do, it's going to give me a nice super green color. So I'm going to take this over and put it on the blender. And I may just add a little touch of water to make sure that it purees well. And those are two dishes out of one preparation, both unique, both different. You could have it one day as the leafy greens. And the next day you could puree it in the blender and get two meals out of one preparation.
All right, so the next time you have a hankering for Indian food, don't order takeout. Make this recipe. Find it at eartheats.org. And, you know, tell us how it turned out when you do make it. We love hearing from you. eartheats@gmail.com. The Earth Eats Brain Trust include Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another week of Earth Eats is in the books. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.